Welcome back to the second episode of the IWA's podcast series, Wales, A Work in Progress, a series that aims to shine a light on the ongoing discussions around how Wales will be governed in the future. Today, we're going to be discussing all things federalism. What is it, and why do people advocate for it as the way forward for Wales and the UK? Federalism, alongside independence and entrenched devolution, is one of the three options being analysed by the Constitutional Commission. So we want to examine this theory in more detail in a Welsh context. My name is Auriel Miller, and I'm Director of the IWA, and I'm delighted to be joined in this discussion by two of the leading thinkers and proponents in Wales of federalism. David Melding was the Conservative MS for South Wales Central from 1999 to 2021, acting as Deputy Presiding Officer Llywyth from 2011 to 2016. David's an acknowledged authority on constitutional reform and is the author of Will Britain Survive Beyond 2020 and The Reformed Union, the UK as a Federation. He's a member of the Federal Trusts Council and a fellow of the IWA. Lindour Kenneth-Jones is an advocate for a UK-wide constitutional convention. He's also a fellow of the IWA and regularly contributes articles and think pieces on Wales's constitutional future. Welcome to you both, Croeso, and thank you very much indeed for joining us as the first guests on the IWA's Wales, A Work in Progress series. So today we're going to be discussing federalism within a Welsh context. Now, obviously, federalism is a really complex word, and we want lots of people engaging with this conversation over this series to be able to break things down. So, David, can I start for you, please, with you breaking down what does federalism mean?
Well, from our point of view, it's best to look at what it would result in. And what it would result in is national autonomy within a wider state being guaranteed. So Wales would have its own domestic autonomy as it does now, but that would be entrenched in divided sovereignty, but it would remain firmly part of the United Kingdom at a state level, as would Scotland, Northern Ireland, as long as it wishes to, and England. So that's the simplest way, I think, of describing it. But it is a constitutional structure that cannot then be changed unless there is mutual agreement between the members of that federation and, you know, it would more simply be Wales, Scotland, England and Northern Ireland.
Mm-hmm. Lindour, do you want to add anything to David's definition?
Yes, you know, it's a mix of self-rule and shared rule. You know, in a federation, sovereignty is shared between central and constituent nation governments, and each level has clearly described functions with some powers pooled between them, but none has absolute authority over the others, with agreed practices confirmed within a written constitution. Collective functions of a federation might typically encompass, to varying degrees, the armed and security forces, border, diplomatic and international affairs, cross-recognition of legal jurisdictions, currency, monetary policies, a single market and select taxation. It was very interesting to note that a person would be a citizen of the overarching entity and the constituent state nation within which they reside, and participating democratically in electing representatives to both levels of government. Typically also a party political system operates across the board.
So we'll come back to that variation of options within federalism in a minute, because that plays into some of the conversations around the Constitutional Commission as well. But so we've got a working definition here of what federalism is. Now, both of you advocate for federalism as the best option for Wales, as well as the wider UK. And David, could you just go into a little bit more why you think federalism is the answer in terms of what it would achieve?
Well, I think it would clarify the constitutional position. Devolution in the UK was introduced really as a way of stopping short of federalism. And then you could say that the Westminster Parliament still had absolute sovereignty. But that model has not really been very effective, because obviously we've gone much further than federal models in dividing sovereignty, in recognising the right of the people of Northern Ireland to leave the Union and join the Republic if they so wished. And also that right now, being with the people of Scotland, and obviously they had a referendum on independence in 2014. And I think by logical inference, you'd have to say that we also recognise the right of the people of Wales and presumably the people of England to leave the Union. And this is a very dramatic division of popular sovereignty. And it could cause a lot of constitutional instability for those that still think the Union should continue. And if we do believe the Union should continue, it would be better to move to federalism because you have the rule book to cope with these sorts of questions. Whereas at the moment, as Glyndŵr has just mentioned, we don't have a written constitution. So we have no real rule book about when we could leave the Union, under what circumstances, how that procedure would go ahead. We've currently seen the attempt by the Scottish Parliament to have an advisory referendum go to the Supreme Court. And now there's all this debate between the Scottish government and the UK government about how long a generation lasts, because it's felt that the right given to the people of Scotland in 2014 was once in a generation. But that was never written down anywhere. It was never a formal agreement. It just came out in rhetoric, really. So the UK is in quite a perilous position constitutionally. And this doesn't make for good decision making, whatever decision you want to make. If it's more structured, whatever the outcome, a continued union or some form of confederation of independent states would work better if we had a framework first to really negotiate these challenges in the future.
So there's something here very basic around clarity of what the rules of the game are. And this is not a game, but clarity around a framework for negotiating positions, and clarity for a defined period of time as well, and equal parity in terms of decision making, and the right to have the option to withdraw from that union at any point in time. Because I think one of the points you made there implicitly was obviously how different the devolution settlement is in different parts of the UK. And that is the case. We know that's the case. Whereas with a federal system, it would be it could still be different in different parts of the UK, but it would be written down and everybody would know what that was. Glyndŵr, let's come to you. I mean, I'm not always going to ask each of you the same sorts of questions, but why federalism in your view?
I mean, I think it's important to note that devolution over the last two decades has developed almost in a piecemeal fashion across the various nations. And the UK is becoming increasingly diverse culturally, ethnically, legally and politically. And a widely accepted approach to successfully embracing such variations is to revise the nature of governance through a constitution. You know, the fact that written constitutions make the machinery of government more accessible and transparent to the public at large is one of the main points in their favour. And in today's world, nearly 200 states are underpinned by written constitutions, and surprisingly, the UK isn't. So establishing a new written framework for these Isles with the support of the four parliaments could prove invaluable across the political spectrum, with some finding reassurance in attempting to articulate the more distinctive elements of the UK's practices in a codified form, and with others seeking to cement the sovereignty position of the four nations individually in relation to a common British structure. But the challenge, of course, is that it is substantial in nature, is to capture our shared ideals and values, British ideals and values, which are often shaped by common geographic, cultural, and historic influences in a framework which strengthens and formalises arrangements for self-government whilst working within an isle-wide structure typified by the values which we all recognise and all aspire to hold: pluralism, tolerance, justice, equality and solidarity. I think it's a picture that we need to sort of look across the piece, across the aisles simultaneously, and possibly take a step back from the drip-by-drip development of devolution, as has been the case.
Okay, so this is an interesting conversation to have, because politics obviously is going to run through all of the different options that are being set out by the Constitutional Commission. Whatever anybody comes to in terms of those options. They will come with their own political standpoint. What we're trying to do this through this series is break things down into what does this mean, what does this look like, and then what then are the pros and cons of each of those options. So I think there's some assumptions in what you're saying just then. You know, the use of the word British, for instance, would be highly contested by particular parts of population of different parts of the nations. Federalism in itself isn't necessarily the only answer in terms of seeking the clarity that we might want. So I'm just pointing this out as we go along. But let's come back to the issues, the two options set out by the Independent Commission on the Constitutional Future of Wales, which in its interim report published in December 2022, set out, you know, within a federal model, there are a number of different ranges of, there's a range of different options, but there's two main variants that it wants to consider as part of its work. Now, the first variant is where financial responsibility for welfare, so by that we mean pensions, unemployment benefits and disability benefits and so forth, that financial responsibility is transferred to the Senate, to the Welsh Parliament, and taxation rests with the Senate. So that's option one. Option two is where welfare remains the responsibility of UK government and Parliament. Now, let's come back. David, you know, as a former MS, you'll have been involved in some of those conversations around what was and what wasn't devolved at the time, based on the acts that had come into force. Can you talk me through your kind of your thoughts on this distinction and whether there be a preference here for you in relation to how you conceive federalism and what that would do and bring for the people of Wales?
Well, I have to say, first of all, I'd be very surprised indeed if the Commission really does mean that the devolved administration in Wales would have financial responsibility for welfare. I think probably what they mean by this option is that there would be very significant and renegotiable transfer of funds from Westminster to cover welfare spending in and then, you know, the Welsh government would make its particular choices and direct funds as they see fit, perhaps modestly add to them or subtract indeed, but add, I'd imagine, would be the option. So it's not really that the Wales as a political entity then has responsibility to raise its own taxes to cover its welfare spending. So it's, you know, it's a bit of a strange option, I think, to emphasize. It's helpful, however, just to remind people that it's quite rare in decentralized systems, federal or otherwise, to have the bulk of welfare devolved. And this is because it's so expensive, but also it's felt that the state, to be coherent, has to have a social contract with its citizens, and that it takes you to a certain level of economic security. And I think to shift away from that is quite dangerous. And I would very much, urge people to resist that. But to have some powers over the application of welfare spending, which is the German model, where it's administered more locally, but is centrally funded by the state, you know, that might be something to look at. But the devolution of welfare is a big, big issue. It's there in fiscal federalism as one of the big dangers if you're not careful. You have to be very precise about why you want it. There with borrowing powers, that's the other classic thing that goes wrong in states that are federal or devolved in terms of poorly constructed borrowing powers. It creates a moral hazard where the sub-state governments borrow far too much and then you have a spending crisis and that can lead to constitutional instability. So I think there needs to be much more thought, really, which I'm sure is part of what the Commissioner will now do, because obviously they're flagging up big issues. But this one really is quite important, I think, to consider very carefully.
But haven't we already gone a little, I mean, we in terms of the UK as a whole, rather than we as Wales, gone already down that path to some extent with the devolution of welfare to Scotland? And I think they are grappling with some of these challenges that you set out. And perhaps one of the issues is that those challenges haven't been widely socialised in terms of what they are, what that means in terms of the change in policy, what that means in terms of the quantum, as well as the bureaucracy and the administrative labour required to implement it. And that's part of that conversation. I suspect we'll come back to dig into what would the devolution of welfare look like in much greater detail with those who are in the weeds of the practicalities of supporting people whose situations are exacerbated by what's famously termed the jagged edge of what is reserved and what is devolved to Wales. And we'll probably come back to the fiscal issues, and almost certainly come back to the fiscal issues and the borrowing powers aspect as well. I guess one of the big question marks, though, for us in considering federalism is, and I suspect this is going to be a specialist subject for each of you, how would federalism work when there is no representative body for England or its regions? Glyndŵr.
Well, you know, you're right to point out England endures as the most highly centralised country in Europe. You know, the limited powers assigned to the mayors and the combined local authorities do not compensate for the centrist culture of both Westminster and Whitehall. 20 years after English domestic policy on health, education, transport, social care, agriculture, childcare was separated from that of the devolved nations, these policies remain the responsibility of the UK government. And John Denham recently pointed out in a report titled English Democracy, England has neither a senior minister, nor a committee of ministers, nor a committee of civil servants, for that matter, that is responsible for coordinating English national policy. This results in a UK government comprising many ministers whose functions, roles, responsibilities rest solely within England, and yet the cabinet itself lacks a clear focus as on England as a territory. And this is where we need to make the debate more nuanced in how we address the problems facing not just England, but also the spillover in terms of the conflicts of interest such an arrangement creates. The situation is compounded by the role of the UK Prime Minister, who doubles up as the English First Minister. And for example, you know, the UK government continues to classify HS2, here's an example, as an England and Wales project, despite no track being laid in Wales. So it's an issue that needs serious discussion. I was very interested to read John Denham's recent piece on Labour List only last Sunday, where he's a strong advocate of movement towards greater decentralisation through city mayors and other initiatives, but simultaneously looking back and looking at the whole and finding a structure that might more closely mirror developments we've already experienced in Wales and Scotland, so that when the time comes, the understanding of a central body sitting overarching these isles could be made purely in terms of what functions, what matters to the people, what matters to Scotland, Wales, England in terms of shared values, shared functions that we can reasonably pool together in a central body and work comfortably, both strategically and financially, to create a better future. A better future for all of us. And I think at this point, it probably is worth mentioning that it's not just federalism is the answer. Possibly there is a confederal model.
Let's come back to that. Let's come back to that in a minute. I'm conscious we're recording this on the 26th of April, 2023. So just to give people a timestamp for going to look for John Denham's article. And we'll come back to the nitty gritty of what's in inverted commas devolved, I would argue decentralized to the regional mayors rather than devolved in the same sense that things are devolved to Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. And to the disparity of that settlement as well, both in terms of the other three nations and the particular questions relating to England. But David, from a politician's perspective, because I suspect you're not, you know, once a politician, always a politician. If the Commission suggests that a federal option might best suit the needs of Wales when it comes to its, I don't think it is going to recommend a particular option, but if it's setting out what those options would be and setting out the advantages of a federal option, how would and how could Wales and Scotland and Northern Ireland, massive ifs in that massive assumptions, particularly in relation to Scotland and Northern Ireland, obviously, how would we ever get to that point with the UK government just not interested in this agenda whatsoever?
Well, I think the short answer to that is if the crisis in Scotland accelerates, then the UK government is going to have to come up with some options for the union being strengthened, if that's the will of the people. Now, we did have a rather panicked response in the final week of the referendum campaign. You may recall all the UK party leaders raced up to, I think it was Edinburgh or maybe in Glasgow, and then made this promise for further devolution, which some took perhaps as taking us towards federalism. But there was the idea that the union had to be renegotiated at a fundamental level. So I don't think the union will survive unless it is renegotiated at a fundamental level, because we will face a second referendum in Scotland. And unless we have a new offer, I think, for the union, for all the nations, not just Scotland, it will be very difficult, I think, to see the current model surviving. I do point out that, of course, by creating devolved institutions in Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland, or re-establishing them, you immediately create an English political system. Now, it's deeply embedded in Westminster, but that's really a decision for the people of England to make. And it took us over a generation to work out that we wanted devolution. And then we took another 12 years to say we wanted devolution with legislative powers in Wales. So I think we need to cut the English some slack and give them time to decide what institutions they want for their domestic affairs. To put a model or enforce a model on them, I think, is very perverse. By recognising the domestic sovereignty of England, I don't think you can then tell them, and oh, you need the same institutions as we have in Scotland and in Wales. There is in federal thinking quite a strong assumption that it ought to be perfectly neat and symmetrical because of the US example, I think. But I think asymmetry or different approaches within a general principle of federalism is not a problem. And presumably that's what we will end up with.
That's a very good moment at which to pause, I think, bearing in mind time frame. So let's just pause there and we'll come back in part two to pick up some of those issues around different models of federalism, and let's knuckle through, Glyndŵr, what confederalism and federalism are.